This is Write the Book, Conversations on Craft, the show for writers and curious readers. I'm Shayla Connor Shapiro. Today on Write the Book, you'll hear a conversation with Vermont author Jennifer McMahon about her new novel, The Children on the Hill, published by Simon & Schuster. Author of 10 novels, including the New York Times bestsellers Promise Not to Tell and The Winter People. She lives in Vermont with her partner Drea and their daughter Zella. Here's some information about The Children on the Hill. 1978. At her renowned treatment center in picturesque Vermont, the brilliant psychiatrist Dr. Helen Hildreth is acclaimed for her compassionate work with the mentally ill. But when she's home with her cherished grandchildren, Vi and Eric, she's just Gran, teaching them how to take care of their pets, preparing them home-cooked meals, providing them with care and attention and love. Then one day, Gran brings home a child to stay with the family. Iris, silent, hollow-eyed, skittish and feral, does not behave like a normal girl. Still, Violet is thrilled to have a new playmate. She and Eric invite Iris to join their monster club, where they catalog all kinds of monsters and dream up ways to defeat them. Before long, Iris begins to come out of her shell. She and Vi and Eric do everything together, ride their bicycles, go to the drive-in, meet at their clubhouse in secret to hunt monsters. Because, as Vi explains, monsters are everywhere. 2019, Lizzie Shelley, the host of the popular podcast Monsters Among Us, is traveling to Vermont, where a young girl has been abducted, and a monster sighting has the town in an uproar. She's determined to hunt it down because Lizzie knows better than anyone that monsters are real, and one of them is her very own sister. When I spoke to Jennifer McMahon last week, I asked her to start by talking a little bit about Mary Shelley and Frankenstein and their influence on Jennifer's work. I hope you enjoy our conversation.
So when I was first thinking about writing this book, I wanted it to be kind of an exploration of monsters and monstrousness and kind of tie in my love of all things monster. And of course, you have to include what I think is the greatest monster story of all time, so Mary Shelley's Frankenstein. And when I was first started thinking about writing this book, I actually thought I'm going to do sort of a modern reinterpretation, like a feminist reinterpretation of Frankenstein. And I thought I'll follow the same kind of general pattern. And I love the overall structure of Frankenstein, right? It's sort of a story within a story within a story. And I love that. And I feel like just the structure is amazing. It's like I think it's called the embedded narrative, where there's a story within a story. It reminds me of those old fashioned Russian dolls, right? You know, where you're kind of peeling back the layers and then you get to the final, the tiny doll, the heart at the center of the story, which is so cool. So I thought about trying to do almost a reinterpretation of that, almost following that exact same framework, but I wasn't, you know, it just wasn't flowing. I actually started out writing and instead of Captain Walton, I had this lesbian bartender in Alaska. It was a very different idea. It was a very different book and it wasn't working. And I couldn't find my way in. And it felt really forced. So I kept putting it away and I kept telling my agent, oh, I'm really excited. I want to write this book kind of inspired by Frankenstein. It's a monster book. And I kept like throwing ideas at him and showing him early ideas and showing him early drafts of things. And at one point we had a conversation. He said, I don't really get it. Tell me your fascination with all of this. And as I was talking to him, I told him about growing up in the 70s with my grandmother, who is a psychiatrist, and how I grew up with her and my love of monsters back then, and that I wanted to kind of incorporate all of that, my growing up with my psychiatrist grandmother and my childhood love of monsters and my love of Mary Shelley's Frankenstein. I wanted to put all of that into a book. And the more I talked to him, the more the idea started flowing. And he said, just write that book. Tell me, you know, write all that down in a book. And so that was sort of the inspiration. And it was only when I got Vi's character, she's the 13-year-old protagonist in the 1979 section, the 1978 section. Mm-hmm. Once I got her character in my head and I started hearing her voice, that was my doorway into the story.
Yeah. Oh, wonderful. Okay. I love hearing stories of novels that started out one way and then ended up going another way. I think that's so helpful because so often we don't really know where we're going when we start writing. And so that's very helpful.
Yeah. Oh my gosh. I never know where I'm going when I start writing. It's always an adventure. You know, like I started with my lesbian bartender in Alaska and she went away. And then I ended up finding Vi, and she was my whole doorway into the story. And I discovered all the other characters from her.
Right.
Yeah. So yeah, no, things never end up going in the direction I think they're going to go.
Right. Yeah.
Yeah.
Let's talk a little bit about you do give us some hints about what's going to happen, and they're not like overt, though. It's just in retrospect, after finishing the book, I see the hints that have been embedded, and I don't want to tell anybody what they are because I don't like spoilers. But you embed maybe a little bit of some objects, some imagery, some ideas that might eventually play a larger role. And I was just wondering if you can talk generally about doing this as a writer.
Yeah. So as I said, I don't really know where a story is going to take me. So I'm not a plotter or planner or outliner in the beginning. I write that first draft and I have no idea where things are going.
Right.
And then once I've got that first draft and once I, you know, print it out and lay it on the floor and restructure and start really getting a sense of the story, then I start thinking about the overall shape of the story and where I want the big twists and turns and how I'm going to set them up. And I think it's a balancing act. You know, I love putting twists and turns and big revelations in my books, but it's tricky, I feel like, to get just the right balance of giving the reader just enough so that when they go back, they're like, oh, this totally makes sense, versus hitting them over the head with something so it'll be obvious. And I think it's like, you know, I think it just comes down to practice, trial and error. A big part of it for me is sharing early drafts with first readers and close friends and my agent, and just getting other readers and other people's opinions to say, does this make sense? Are you getting this? Like, if you get to this point in the story, is this like a complete surprise or was it obvious all along? I have a lot of trusted readers that I share early drafts with, and that's a big help. Yeah.
Okay, great. I have like other writerly questions, but I want to talk a little bit about the specifics of this book before I go to those, because I want people to know what the heck we're talking about. So you have these wonderful characters. You've got Vi and Eric in 1979, and Iris, who joins them early in the book as another sort of sister character. And they are being raised by Gran. And then you also have a present day storyline where Vi and Eric have actually changed their names, but we don't know exactly why. She says, we changed our names after what had happened, which is this great, like, suspenseful comment that's created by withholding some background information. So now you've told us that you grew up in a situation with your grandmother who was a psychiatrist. So other than that background, how did you develop Vi and Eric and Iris?
I definitely relied on a lot of my own memories of growing up in the 70s, with my psychiatrist grandmother. You know, things were different in the 70s.
They were, right?
They were. You know, we ran wild. We were like out in the woods all the time. You know, my grandmother would have a bell that she rang to call us in when it was time to come home. And we were just kind of on our own all the time. And I relied on my memories of that. And another thing is that, you know, my grandmother was a psychiatrist, like the grandmother in the book. And things were different in terms of psychiatry in the 70s. There weren't like the boundaries and the confidentiality issues we have today, at least not in my grandmother's circle. So in addition to all her psychiatrist friends who would be coming into the house, we also had like her patients and ex-patients who are visitors in our house, and they would come for dinners and for holidays sometimes and for summer visits. We had one guy who came every summer who would just be naked and drink bottles of bourbon every night. And it was just like, it just seemed normal to us. These were like that was the way our life was. They were just kind of constant fixtures in our lives. So I relied on, you know, my memories of that and just thinking about it. I did do a little research and I had a lot of fun going back and kind of thinking about talking to friends and family and just going back and reading about what games were popular in 1978 and thinking about like all the games we used to play. There's a scene where the kids are playing Rock'em Sock'em Robots.
Right,
and
I
totally remember my brother had that and we would have a blast of those. And there's, I mentioned like Light Brights, and I just had so much fun like researching that. And so, you know, all I would see was like a picture of an old Light Bright ad, and it would just bring me back through time. And I remembered being a kid and so wanting that Light Bright set and getting it and making the cool designs. And I relied on a lot of my own memories for that. But that said, you know, these characters are not me. but I put a link. There's more of me in this book than any other book I've written, for sure.
Oh, interesting.
There's a lot of me in Bai, I think. And I think that writing her voice came to me so easily because there was so much me in her. I grew up loving monsters and loving to read and get swept away in other worlds.
Now I love that, and partly this is because I produce a podcast, but I love that as an adult, Vi, who becomes Lizzie, has a monster hunting podcast, and she's kind of got a following. She's a little bit famous because she's also done some other projects that have a lot of visibility. So that was really fun. And I wanted to, so she says, my mission was to do everything I could to get the message out loud and clear. Monsters are real and living among us. Did you, in researching for her work, did you find other podcasts that are like this one, and specifically maybe about monsters?
I did. I did listen to some monster podcasts, and I listened to some podcasts sort of just about cryptids and like just creepy podcasts where people like told their own stories about, people were interviewed about telling their own stories about encounters with other creatures and supernatural beings and stuff. So I did do that. And that was really fun. And in the beginning, I just had the character who goes by Lizzie in the modern day storyline in 2019. I had her just being a monster hunter. She wasn't a podcaster at first. And I thought, well, she needs a blog. And then I thought, no, which I think an editor suggested, well, maybe she has a podcast. And I was like, yes, she has a podcast. Of course, she has a podcast. And I had so much fun, like envisioning what her life would be like going around interviewing people about these, their supposed monster sightings and just being a monster expert. Yeah. And it was fun. Also, I did monster like cryptid research, and I made up some of the creatures in the story, but some of them were based on real.
Oh, I was going to ask you.
Yeah. Some of them were real and some of them were made up. There's the one that I made, the big one I made up plays an important role in the story is Rattling Jane in Vermont.
Right.
We made her up. I took bits and pieces from sort of other stories and then my own imagination and made up this entity that like comes out of the lake and supposedly pulls people in.
Right.
So I had a lot of fun. I had fun with that.
Now, at one point, Lizzie talks about spending hours and hours in the woods. This is a quote, in cornfields, in old mines, in abandoned houses, at the edges of rivers and lakes, searching, waiting, willing them to show themselves to me. Year after year, I chased monsters, feeling just behind them, touching their shadows sometimes. This reminds me so much of another person who lives in Montpelier who follows Sasquatch, who he's been on the show, Chris Noel. He talks about, you know, being in the woods. Did you talk to Chris at all? Or did you like think about Chris while you were writing about her?
You know, I did think about Chris. He has a book called Impossible Visits that I read years ago. And I love Chris and I love hearing his stories. And I love his like ongoing belief that they're out there. He like is a firm believer that these creatures are out there. I did think about that. Definitely.
Yeah. I mean, apart from anything else, I just have such respect for Chris, like spending the night in the woods, like year round. And when I read that from her, I was like, wow, that's really very, very intense, that kind of research.
The kind of research and just the dedication.
Yes.
And the bravery, frankly, I don't know that I would go off in the woods by myself and not have a campfire and just be waiting for encounters with other beings.
Exactly.
I would be terrified.
Particularly if you really believed in other beings.
Yeah, I would just be so scared. And I know in the past, Chris has led like groups into the woods to search and do overnight trips. And
oh, he has.
I thought, oh, that would be fun, but I would also be really scared.
Yeah. let's see. You have the two timelines we've talked about, a present tense looking back and then the 1970s storyline. So I wonder if you can talk about, so sometimes you fill in background from between the periods a little bit. And I wonder if you can talk about writing background without stalling the narrative and without doing a big info dump, because I think that can be really hard for writers to figure out.
Yeah, I mean, it is for sure. So when I was writing, I had the two storylines, the 1978 and the 2019. And then also in there, I've got like excerpts from the Book of Monsters that the kids write. And then I've got excerpts from a true crime book.
Right.
So I've got those bits in there too. And I feel like particularly when you've got more than one timeline, it's really important to kind of end each section of each timeline with something that's going to make the reader want to read on to find out what's going to happen in the next section. Because I think it's easy to lose people. I know I've read books with dual timelines or more than one timeline, several timelines. And by the time I get back to the timeline I'm most interested in, I've kind of forgotten what's been happening.
Right, right.
So it's tricky. My chapters are not horribly long, and I think that helps.
Yep.
And a big part of it is just organizing. When I do that critical, like, print and put the book out on the floor thing, and I'm like getting a visual sort of bird's eye view of what's happening and making sure that things flow and making sure that, you know, I've got a smooth transition from the past storyline to the present storyline, and then we can get back into the past and remember what's happened. And I hope I did it okay. It's always a challenge not to do big info dumps. And sometimes I am totally guilty of doing the big info dump when I'm writing my first chapters. I mean, my first drafts, right? My first drafts, it's like, I've got like huge sections that are big info dumps and total messes. And I just need to look at the big info dumps and find out, what does a reader really need to know?
Right.
And is there another place that I can put this in instead of just having everything in there?
Yeah.
And with this book, one of the fun ways I did it was, you know, I had the true crime book where I could describe some of what was going on at the inn and some of like Gran's history and her past and like hint at things that were to come. And that was a fun way to get more information in. And also I used that to kind of get the general landscape and layout of the land in a different way than in Vi's first person, not first person, but in her point of view sections.
Right. I thought you did a really great job. I want to clarify that, because I think anytime anything changes, if it's setting, if it's narrator, if it's time period, it can be a challenge to transition that well so that the reader isn't going like, no, I want to stay back where I was. And I thought you did it really well. So, and you mentioned the books within the book. You have The Book of Monsters by Violet Hildreth and Iris, whose last name we don't know, illustrations by Eric Hildreth, which I loved, which is the children's book that they wrote in 1978. And then you have The Helping Hand of God, The True Story of the Hillside Inn by Julia Tetrault, which is a real book, not a real book in our life, I don't think, but a real book to them. So, and it sounded, from what you've said already, but I also was curious if this was fun to do the book within the book, the two books within the book.
Oh my gosh, it was so much fun. I loved it. I particularly loved, I mean, The Helping Hand of God, The True Crime was fun because I do enjoy reading true crime sometimes. And it was kind of fun to try to do something in that true crime voice. And so that was really fun. And it was a good way to get in details that I didn't know how to get them in otherwise.
Yes.
But I particularly loved doing the monster sections from the kids. The Book of Monsters bits, where they're describing, because the kids are monster obsessed. They just love all things monster. And they're writing down this book where they write everything they know or think they know about monsters. And there's a page on each monster they know. And there are pages on like how to fight monsters, how to protect yourself from monsters. And I got so into it that I was like, I wrote a bunch of Book of Monsters sections that did not end up in the book. We actually had to cut quite a few of them out. I had so many in the beginning. I wrote a lot. And I, I was even like, when I was writing them out, I was even doing some of Eric's little drawings with them when I was doing them, because it was fun and it kind of was another doorway into the book. And I thought, oh, wouldn't it be cool if I made an actual Book of Monsters that was like just like their Book of Monsters? Because it's their Book of Monsters is just in an old 3-ring binder, and it's, you know, notebook pages that are written and Eric's drawings and magic marker and crayon. And I thought that that'd be really fun, but that's a project I didn't completely finish. I did some pages for it, but.
Well, if you were J.K. Rowling, that would be next on your list, right?
Yeah. I'm also a really terrible artist, but I have a lot of fun trying to draw.
So. Oh, it's fun though. And I think even if you don't end up putting it out there for your readers, it's great for you to just sort of see it all unfold on your, you know, living room floor or wherever you're working.
Oh, totally. And it's just, you know, any way that I can find like a connection with my characters and kind of a doorway into the story. And often that is through like doing journals. And, you know, for my last book, The Drowning Kind, there was a big part was journals from one of the characters, and I wrote all of her journals out by hand, and I ended up incorporating very few of them into the book, but it was all really useful for me to get to know her. And same thing with this. It was a useful way for me to get to know the kids, and sort of an insight into their world was writing all these Book of Monsters bits.
Yeah, that was really fun. Now, you've already talked to this, you've spoken to this, and I have a feeling that you don't have like any specific prototypical structure that you use. But I just do want to ask that question, because I think a lot of writers will talk about the beats of a mystery or the beats of a thriller. And some you know, new writers might not know what that means, or and if there's some sort of like outline that people use for structuring their suspense novels. So do you have anything like that? Or is anything similar from one book to the next when you're structuring?
I try to, not necessarily when I'm writing, but definitely after I've got the book on the floor and I go back and I outline and I start structuring, I try to sort of loosely follow the three-act structure.
Okay.
So, you know, act one, act two, act three, and I've got little climaxes at the end of each act, you know, the act one climax, act two, part one climax, the midpoint climax, all that. And so I try to do that. It's not set in stone, and it's not something I completely follow rigidly, but I try to just generally have a few of those beats in there. And I feel like that helps me have with the overall structure. But it's also saying that it's also tricky when I've got two timelines, because I have to make sure that I've got two act one climaxes and two midpoint climaxes, and that things flow together and are happening sort of at the same point in the book. That makes sense.
Now, yeah. And did you develop your kind of approach, or are there resources that you would recommend that you read about or looked into, and then you kind of like transitioned into your own approach?
Oh, gosh. A big book that helped me with just overall storytelling that I read and reread from time to time is Joseph Campbell's Hero with a Thousand Faces.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
You know, and that's just, that kind of tells the whole hero's journey story. And I don't follow that specifically, but it taught me a lot about storytelling and important beats in a story. I also have read like screenwriting books like Save the Cat, but it's so easy these days also to, you know, like just go online and Google three-act structure and you can get a tome. Yes, a tome. But I'm also a believer in like, there shouldn't be like strict rules you follow. The story wants to do its own thing and go its own way. And you have to be true to the story.
No, I think that's the perfect answer, is like, you've got this kind of general thing that you try to stick to, but you don't like, you're not adhering to like 1A, 1B, 1C.
Oh my gosh. Yeah. No, I couldn't do that. No.
Now we're already talking about books that you've read. I may put you on the spot again. Have you read any other, not craft books, but other books lately that you would recommend to listeners, just books that you've enjoyed recently?
Oh yeah. Let's see. Recently, I read The Fervor by Alma Katsu, who wrote The Hunger and The Deep.
Yeah, and she's been on this show, actually.
Oh my gosh, she's so great. I love her. She's so smart. And she's one of the coolest people I know because she was a spy.
Oh, yeah.
She also has a great spy novel, too, Red Widow. But yeah, The Fervor was just a wonderful, creepy take on... it's set in the Japanese internment camp. And okay. Every time I read her, I feel like she does historical horror like no one else. Every time I read her, I know that she's taking real bits of real history in and kind of incorporating them and using them sort of as a jumping off point to go someplace really unique and strange and sometimes really terrifying. So I always learn things. Like I learned a lot about the Japanese internment camps, and it was one of those things. I was reading the book and I kept Googling to see how much of it was true. And a lot of it was true. And she just took a lot of truth. And, there were things called fire balloons that I'd never heard of. And so I learned all about fire balloons. And anyway, The Fervor by Alma Katsu. She's wonderful.
Okay.
What else have I read recently? I've been on a Stephen Graham Jones kick. I love The Only Good Indians, and I read My Heart is a Chainsaw recently, which just won the Stoker Award for Best Novel, and absolutely loved it. It's, you know, if you don't do kind of bloody, gory horror, maybe it's not for you. There are parts that get a little out there, but I absolutely loved it. I loved the character of Jade that he created, and it's kind of like an ode to the 80s slasher movies.
Oh, great.
And I thought it was really well done. And the man can write like nobody's business. He is so talented. It amazes me.
Okay. That's great. This is a quote from your book. And it's Lizzie talking about the Julia Tetreault book. That's Helping Hand of God, The True Story of the Hillside Inn. And so Lizzie says, I used to have a copy of the book, a copy I had dog-eared, written all over, crossed out and corrected sections. I thought briefly of sending it to the author, Julia Tetreault, but no, parts of the story could never be told. So I was curious, this just took me to a different place. Do fans ever do this to you? Does anybody ever send back your books with like things marked? And if not, do you get interesting and odd mailings from fans?
Oh, thank goodness no one has ever done that. I would find that a little intimidating. I do get interesting email. One of the things I absolutely love is that every reader approaches any book with their own background and their own set of values and their own thoughts, and they're going to bring their own interpretations to it. And so I absolutely love hearing what different readers pick up on and take out of things. And I, especially if it's something like, you know, they'll write me and say, oh, I love the way you did this, this, and this, and the way it all lined up perfectly. And it was a metaphor for this. And I won't even realize that, like, it's something I hadn't done intentionally. And maybe some other creative part of my brain put that in there, but maybe it was accidental. I don't know, but it's just kind of magical. And I just love hearing what other readers pick up on and bring to the story. And every now and then I get an angry person who's not happy with something. Sometimes it's the language. Sometimes it's I don't know. Like I said, everybody brings their own stuff to a book. So anything can upset someone. So yeah. Every now and then I do get the unhappy, like, I'm never going to read your books again. And I'm telling my friends not to read it. I'm telling the library not to carry your books. And and that's okay. You know, there are books out there for everyone. I know my books aren't for every reader, but it's all good.
It's funny. So I'm going to have to bleep this if I keep it in. But speaking of language not being appreciated by certain readers. So I have a friend who's an author, and I went to her local library to do a reading years ago, And at the end of the reading, a woman raised her hand and said, you know, I think that there shouldn't be bad language in books. What do you think? And she sort of gave this long, protracted answer about, no, I think, it has to be honest. And sometimes there is bad language in the world. And, you know, she kind of gave this answer. And then the woman sat down and looked kind of rattled and pissy. And then the next week, that friend of mine went to a reading at the same library by Natalie Goldberg. You know Natalie Goldberg?
Oh, yeah.
So the same woman was there. And she raised her hand and she asked the same question. And she said, do you think there should be bad language in books? And Natalie Goldberg said, yes. 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 And the woman laughed.
Oh, that's the best answer ever.
That's so funny.
That's the best answer ever. It's not something I worry about. I there are definitely, there are swears in my books, but I'm not overly concerned about it. I probably don't swear enough for some people. I probably swear too much for others.
Right.
But it's all good. Like you said, you have to be true to the story and to the characters. And if I'm hearing a character's voice loud and clear in my head and they want to say the F word, it's going to come out.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay, great. I just have really one last question for you, Jennifer. And I'm not going to give any spoilers, but because some of the reviews already say that you have a little bit of a twist in your ending, I'm going to ask about that. I like to ask for advice for writing ending, or I like to ask for advice for writers. And so I want to ask you about advice for endings. And sometimes maybe there's a little bit of an unexpected surprise in an ending. So if you do that, what are the rules in your mind, and how do you maybe advise people about writing endings?
My first advice is that when I write an ending, it's almost never the ending that is going to appear in the finished book.
Oh, okay.
my ending often changes and morphs and goes through different incarnations as I go through revisions. That said, with this book, I always knew very clearly like what the ending was going, like where the characters were going to be in the end.
Okay.
And I think my advice would be try out different endings. if something doesn't, and trust your gut, you know, if it feels right, and even if it's something that might upset people or doesn't seem to make sense, but if it feels right, go with it and make it work. But if something feels off, try different approaches. You know, try ending, what would happen if you ended it in a completely different way? What would happen if you ended it, like, make a list of all the possible ways that your book could end and see what ideas you come up with.
That's a great idea.
And the biggest thing is, like, you know, you have to, everything in your story from the beginning all the way through has to be leading up to this moment of the end. And your character has to go on a journey and start off in one place and end up in another. And it all has to make sense and almost feel like it's come full circle in some ways in my mind. That's the way I look at it.
Right.
So that's what I'm thinking about when I'm thinking about how to craft a good ending is, have we gone on a journey? Have they learned what they needed to learn? Did it get them to this place? Does it make sense? And does it feel like it's kind of come full circle?
Wonderful. Okay. That is fantastic. I love that advice. I want to just mention again, the name of the book is The Children on the Hill, published by Simon & Schuster and written by my guest today, Jennifer McMahon. It was really fun. Thank you for talking to me again.
Very fun. Very fun. It's good to see you again.
From the Media Factory in the south end of Burlington, Vermont, this is 99.3 FM, WBTV LP Burlington. Streaming online at 99.3wbtv.org. This is Write the Book, the show for writers and curious readers. I'm Shayla Connor Shapiro. That was an interview with Vermont author Jennifer McMahon. You can learn more about her work at jennifermcmahon.com. This week's Write the Book prompt was generously suggested by my guest, Jennifer McMahon. At its heart, The Children on the Hill is an exploration of monsters and monstrousness. So Jennifer's writing prompt is to create your own monster. Here's what she wrote to me. What type of monster is it? Does it have a name? What does it look like? What does it sound like? Where does your monster live? Who can see it? What does your monster eat? What special abilities does it have? Can it run fast? Is it super strong? Can it hibernate for years? What does your monster want most? What's stopping your monster from getting it? What is your monster most afraid of? Now, write two scenes, the first from the point of view of a person, maybe a character you've already been working with, coming across your monster. Where do they meet? Is your monster a danger to this character? How does your character feel about this creature? Write the same scene from the monster's point of view. What is the monster thinking and feeling? Is your monster afraid of the person, or is it longing for connection? Or is it just really, really hungry? Good luck with your work in the coming week. And please tune in next week for another prompt or suggestion. Good luck with your work in the coming week, and tune in next week for another prompt or suggestion. I'd love your feedback about the show. Let me know if you'd like me to interview certain authors or if you have events to announce. Be sure to tell your friends about Write the Book and about the podcast site, writethebook.podbean.com, where you can get all of the archived episodes. New and recent episodes of Write the Book are available wherever you get your podcasts. Just subscribe to have them sent to your podcast app. A reminder to listeners who write, I do share a writing prompt each week, so be sure to check the archives of Write the Book if you'd like to find any that you might have missed. You can also access the podcast and link to our social media presence at my own website, shelaughswithoutus.com. If you like the show, please rate it where you find it and talk about it with the people who might enjoy it. Up next at 5, stay tuned for Feminist Frenzy, the radio show with a feminist agenda. I'm Shayla Connor Shapiro, and you've been listening to Write the Book. This is 99.3 FM, WBTV LP, Burlington, Vermont, streaming online at 99.3wbtv.org. Stay well and have a great week.